The U.S. military has a problem, nowhere near enough people signing up.
The Army missed its recruiting mission in 2022. Not only did they miss it in 22, they missed it by a historic amount, like 25%.
Also today, the Japanese government has a proposition for Tokyo residents. Get out of town and we'll give you cold, hard cash. Former city dwellers say moving is well worth it.
There's so many people, it's so crowded all the time. If you think about living peacefully, I think the countryside is much, much better.
I'm Marco Werman, and in parts of Africa, the indictment of a former American president is being watched closely, for some with envy.
This principle of no one, even a former president, being above the law is not something that has been popularly experienced across the African continent.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. The big story dominating headlines today, we will get there in a bit. We start at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and this scene, Finland's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Pekka Haavisto, passing a large gray folder to his American counterpart, Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We can now declare that Finland is the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty.
And with that, 832 more miles of Russian border now butts up against the latest member of NATO. For more about what this means, we called up retired Admiral James Stavridis. Admiral, how much stronger does Finland's addition make NATO?
By creating this 800-plus mile border, it forces Putin to dilute his forces. He has to provide defenses in a way that he really hasn't had to do before. So geography is an important point. The Finns have an incredibly capable military. I know it well. I commanded their troops. They deployed alongside NATO to Afghanistan, to the Balkans, came on many missions with us, and they can put 250,000 highly trained troops in the field in about 90 days. They have mandatory conscription, a draft. Everybody's trained. They're refreshed. They have their weapons. There's an intangible aspect to this, which is the way the Finns feel about the Russians. The Russians invaded Finland in 1939, the so-called Winter War. The Finns fought them to a standstill. They are tough people with a very clear-eyed view of Russia. We are lucky to have them. It's a great day in Brussels. It's a bad day in Moscow.
Could you argue, though, that adding Finland is a liability for NATO? Because there's considerably more NATO now on Russia's border, and NATO's Article 5 says clearly an attack on one nation is an attack on all.
I would turn that around and simply say that what this does is immensely complicate Vladimir Putin's calculus. In other words, instead of feeling as though he can drive toward Estonia and attack that very small geographic member of the alliance, he can no longer count on a neutral Finland off on his right side, his right flank. So I would argue bringing them in enhances NATO's position. I can tell you this with complete assurance. NATO is not going to invade Russia. We don't have any war plans to do that. But Putin doesn't think that way. So this creates real complications for him.
So NATO is a defensive alliance, but troops and weapons are a huge part of its shared power. You mentioned a 250,000 troops up in 90 days if needed. How much more military capability in terms of just hardware does Finland bring to NATO?
Very capable military, more artillery than any other country in Europe. And this is all quite remarkable with a country with a population of only 5 million. But they have been on the border of Russia as an independent state only for about a century. Before that, they had their throat under a Russian boot for centuries. They don't like it. And they have, therefore, a very capable armed forces. And by the way, they work very closely with their Baltic counterparts, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, just across the Gulf of Finland. And they work very closely with the Swedes. I think we're going to see Sweden in the alliance next, another plus for NATO.
I mean, it sounds, Admiral, like you're saying Finland joining NATO is a game changer for Russia's war in Ukraine. Is it really?
I don't think it's a game changer for the war in Ukraine. I think it is a very significant strategic plus for the alliance. Now, as we look at the war in Ukraine specifically, that conflict is still very much in balance. But what this does is add to the complications that Putin has to deal with. And in that sense, it will influence the war in Ukraine. But no, it's not a sudden game changer that will crack that open in favor of the Ukrainians.
At the same time, Russian officials are saying they will add military forces to the area right across the border from Finland if NATO forces are placed in Finland. So do you call that an escalation by either side, really?
The way I look at it, Marco, first of all, I'm wondering where these forces are going to come from. Russia is having all it can handle, maintaining 100,000 to 200,000 troops inside Ukraine. They're mobilizing in the form of dragging people out of prisons and homeless shelters and pushing them to the front. So I'm skeptical that Putin is going to suddenly come up with another 100,000 troops against this border. What I see it as is a ratification of Finland's ability to defend itself. It's now part of a major alliance system. I don't see that as an escalation. I see it as additive to the alliance and a challenge for Russia.
Admiral, earlier you called this a great day in Brussels, which is, of course, NATO headquarters. What do you find most interesting about Finland joining NATO?
Above all, it is the diplomatic and political signal being sent here by a nation that has famously been neutral since the 1930s. And same with Sweden, which again, I think is just behind Finland. What those two nations are saying to Vladimir Putin is, we are concerned about the way you've attacked Ukraine, and we're going to join this alliance. It is a game changer in Helsinki and Stockholm for these two previously neutral nations to decide they want to be on our team.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis, as always, thank you very much.
I got to say, you started by saying we'll get to the big story of the day. I presume you mean Donald Trump. You and I just did the big story of the day, frankly. So thanks for including me.
So let's get to that, not the biggest news story of the day. Now, former President Donald Trump appeared in court this afternoon for his arraignment. Across the African continent, leaders, lawmakers, and ordinary citizens are following the Trump news to see what lessons it offers for the strength of the rule of law. Chris Marolang is executive director of Good Governance Africa. He's usually based in Johannesburg, but today we caught up with him in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. I asked him if Trump's legal battles were making headlines in capitals across sub-Saharan Africa.
Absolutely. I think one of the key things about it is that it has really serious implications around issues related to governance and the rule of law, not just in the United States, but really here on the African continent. And that's why there's so much interest, because not just of the popularity, or can I say the infamous nature of President Trump, but really because it has many themes that relate to the state of governance on the African continent.
So we'll get to that in a second, but just give us a sense of what the tone of the news coverage is today.
Well, I think the tone of the news coverage has really been one of kind of like a fly on the wall, looking at American institutions working. And I think it's almost something that we look at with somewhat of envy here in sub-Saharan Africa, because this principle of no one, even a former president being above the law, is not something that has been popularly experienced across the African continent.
So you said earlier that Trump's arraignment today, as well as his other legal problems, it has implications on good governance in Africa. Talk more about that.
One concept that is really championed by countries like China and indeed Russia, which talks to governance efficiency, that is, the state must simply deliver services to the people, is contrast the creation of what you might describe as a false dichotomy with the concept of inclusive governance, which is a form of governance that talks about accountability, transparency, the rule of law, and human rights. And ultimately, what we're seeing here is really a demonstration by the United States that you take the concept of inclusivity of governance, that is, that leaders at the highest level must be held to account There must be transparency in the systems of governance, and the rule of law must ultimately apply equally to all citizens.
So a criminal investigation into a leader is not hypothetical for South Africans. Your country's former president, Jacob Zuma, was charged with multiple counts of corruption and resigned while in office, only to face criminal charges dating back to a 1999 arms deal. Do you see any sort of parallel in the two former presidents' legal woes?
One of the similarities was that these two presidents seemed to believe the laws did not apply to them, that somehow they were above the laws. But our courts and our judicial systems have actually spoken and have said that concept of good governance and inclusivity and ultimately the fact that all are equal before the law are principles that both countries clearly take seriously.
The jailing of Jacob Zuma sparked riots in parts of South Africa that left more than 300 people dead. He was freed on medical parole 2 months later. And now two courts have ruled that Zuma should return to prison. Do you think there's any sort of lesson in Zuma's saga for the U.S. legal system?
The lessons are about the strength of institutions in both countries. Even though there were attempts to undermine the state, our institutions remain strong and steadfast. And we've seen a similar thing in the United States, where a public insurrection, no less, in Washington, D.C., failed, and the institutions, democracy, ultimately prevailed.
But across Africa, we see that good and effective governance is a hard thing to muster.
Unfortunately, we have seen some backsliding. We've seen unconstitutional changes in power. That's a euphemism for coups in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And this has really raised questions amongst proponents of good governance and democracy that this backsliding could usher in a narrowing of democratic space in some parts of Africa.
Do countries in your region look to the U.S. still as an example to follow?
Less so. And this is really because of the backsliding that we've witnessed in the United States itself, especially the narrowing of these strong democratic principles, especially during the Trump administration.
I mean, the take from China is that Trump's arraignment is proof of the dysfunction of democracy, especially democracy in the U.S. Are you hearing that anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa?
Yes, certainly, especially when you consider the fact that there's really a battle for the soul of governance in Africa, where on the one hand, they are the proponents of what you'd call effective governance, which doesn't really talk about higher order rights like accountability and transparency. On the other hand, there's a huge contestation with proponents of inclusive governance, similar to that of America, where accountability, transparency, rule of law, human rights are important. So this basically means that as this contestation continues to intensify in Africa and geopolitically, as countries like China and Russia on the African continent really push for a less democratic form of governance, it's important that we have proponents of democracy and good governance.
So what lessons do you think sub-Saharan Africa's least democratic leaders see when they watch these multiple criminal investigations into President Trump? What's their takeaway?
Well, that takeaway is definitely that in well-governed countries, irrespective of your position, the law has a long arm and will catch up with you ultimately. However, this has probably an unintended consequence in that it enhances the resolve of autocrats, dictators, not just in Africa, but across the world, to really try and entrench their undemocratic form of governance in order to avoid prosecution, which is really a sad, unintended lesson that they might be learning from this.
Chris Marolang is Executive Director of Good Governance Africa. He's typically based in Johannesburg, but he joined us today from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Chris, great to have you with us today. Thank you.
It's been a privilege. Thank you for having me on your program.
Tokyo is too crowded, but the government there has a plan to get young people to leave the big city. That is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. With nearly 40 million residents, Tokyo is the world's most populous city. It's so overcrowded that the government is actually paying people to leave. 1 million yen per child, about 7,500 U.S. dollars. The goal, create some breathing room in Tokyo and, as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, help repopulate other places around the country.
Sumina Hayashi was exhausted after living in Tokyo and working in advertising for 8 years.
Yes, so many people, it's so crowded all the time. It's a good place to like learn or work, but if you think about living peacefully, I think the countryside is much, much better.
So when her husband asked her to move to the countryside, Hayashi jumped at the opportunity. About 4 years ago, she quit her job and traveled to the small agricultural village of Soni in Nara Prefecture. She now works for the local government there. It's a 2.5-hour train ride east of Osaka and is surrounded by lush forests and highlands.
People are very friendly, bright, and happy compared to Tokyo.
What the village offers in quality of life, though, it lacks in population. Kazuhito Kikuhara also lives in Soni.
The population is only 1,300.
Half of that population is 65 and over. That's compared to less than a third nationwide and just 16% in the U.S. And in the village of Soni, Kikuhara says the total population is dropping by about 100 people per year.
Maybe half of that is from death, and the remaining half is moving out. So the pace is really, really rapid.
That's what he is in town to help with, though. For the past year and a half, Kikuhara worked for the local government, trying to revitalize the village. He says when he first arrived, the only businesses in town were two mom-and-pop type shops.
No convenience store, and I couldn't find any restaurant to have a dinner at all.
He has since helped fix up vacant houses and tried to create more job opportunities. Kikuhara also meets with people living in Tokyo and other urban areas to convince them to move to the village. He says about 1 in 10 people he's spoken with actually make the move, which he's happy with. He doesn't think the government's million yen incentive is going to make much of a difference.
It becomes a kind of booster, but it doesn't become a game changer.
He says game-changing money would need to be in the ballpark of 10 to 100 million yen per kid. Kikuhara isn't expecting that kind of money to come anytime soon. But villages like Soni all around Japan are in desperate need of more residents. Yves Tibergen is the director of the Center for Japanese Research at the University of British Columbia. He says villages in Japan have been depopulating since the 60s.
In part, you know, it was young people moving to better paying jobs than farming in the cities. So that's how it started.
As more young people left the villages, fewer young people wanted to stay. Now, many towns are in danger of disappearing altogether due to dying populations. If populations get too small, Tokyo transplant Sumina Hayashi says villages are sometimes forced to merge with nearby cities and end up losing their identities. She's hoping that doesn't happen to Soni.
I think the village would be more happier if it stays independent. It should be separated in order to keep the uniqueness.
Hayashi is doing her part to keep the village going. Part of her work with the local government is to attract tourists. She says she wants vacationers to see the beauty the land has to offer, but she also knows tourism will create local job opportunities and hopefully draw city dwellers to the countryside full-time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The U.S.-Mexico border is among the most patrolled and watched-over borders in the world. 327 surveillance towers now dot the border on the U.S. side. That's according to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF. Dave Moss has been following this growing surveillance. He's the director of investigations at EFF and joins us from Reno, Nevada. Your organization, Dave, has a new map detailing the location of the surveillance towers. Give us a landscape. Is there a concentration anywhere, or are they evenly spaced from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific?
Well, there are certain areas where there's higher concentrations. So over the last few years, San Diego County in Southern California has become very concentrated with a variety of towers, as has the El Paso area and the Laredo area. And then if you look at our map, down from McAllen to Brownsville, it is just a clear line of surveillance towers.
What do they actually see?
So historically, they've had a lot of these cameras that transmit video to a command center, a C2 center, which is often like a portable building where, you know, CBP and Border Patrol officers sit in front of TV screens watching footage. And generally, they could see video using long-range electro-optical cameras, or they could see infrared, so they could get some night vision going on.
I mean, the number of surveillance towers has grown since the EFF report was issued last month. How fast is the surveillance tower project moving, and why so fast?
You know, we went out to the border. We've been out to the border three times over the last year, and there have been a significant number of towers that have just popped up just over the last 6 to 8 months. So this stuff is moving really quickly. It has been moving pretty quickly since 2020. But in the next fiscal year, between now and the end of fiscal year 2025, Customs and Border Protection plans to install 175 new towers at a cost of $204 million. This is about roughly like $1 million per tower.
How is that justified by Washington, given some of your critiques of these surveillance towers?
You know, the border is a very politicized space, and I get the sense that border security is less about actual security and more about the perception of security. And so you have both political parties claiming that there needs to be more done. Under the Trump administration, it was build the wall. Under the Biden administration, it's still build the wall, but also do this virtual border thing.
What exactly is the work of the Electronic Frontier Foundation? What do you do?
Electronic Frontier Foundation has been around since 1990 to protect people's rights and civil liberties as technology advances in society.
So how did the border and these surveillance towers come into your focus?
So we've been planning a bunch of trips along the U.S.-Mexico border to understand the impacts of surveillance technology on communities. And one of the things we wanted to do was look at this technology, see it in person. And so we started going through public records posted online, environmentalists, assessments, procurement documents, started going through satellite view and Google Street View, even went into virtual reality and put on the headset and did Google Street View that way, where I would just drop myself along the border and just look around to see if I could map out a surveillance tower.
Aside from this map that you and the EFF developed, what is the impact on the communities that you saw firsthand from surveillance?
A variety of use cases here. So just to inform communities about what's going on. We talked to people at the border just last week who didn't know that there was like a surveillance tower in, you know, downtown Eagle Pass. They thought it was a cell phone tower. And these are people who work with migrants every day and are working with immigrant populations on a regular basis. It does create more of an opportunity for people to get involved when there is a public process, an environmental assessment where people do have the ability to object to the placement of towers. People will know, like, this stuff is in our community and we can push back, or we can talk to our member of Congress.
Dave Moss is the Director of Investigations at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He joined us from Reno, Nevada. Thanks very much, Dave.
Thank you.
We will be right back with more news for you in the next 30 minutes of the show. You're listening to The World. Pandemic isolation delayed the emotional development of many children, including some from new immigrant families. Teachers and mental health professionals are giving these preschoolers in Boston's Chinatown some tools to process their emotions.
If you feel very angry, you can sit down and look in the mirror.
Helping at-risk children cope with stress. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If you're an American of a certain age, you'll probably remember this TV ad.
Before 9 a.m. than most people do all day.
The 1980s Be All You Can Be recruiting campaign is making a 2023 comeback.
So you can be all you can be.
Be all you can be.
The reason for bringing that marketing back is an essential problem for the American military. It's not attracting nearly enough recruits. The World's Daniel Offman has our story.
The new ad campaign kicked off last month. It's been almost 50 years since the end of the draft, but now the all-volunteer force is running into a huge challenge. Gabe Camarillo is Under Secretary of the Army. Here he is speaking to members of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
In FY22, the Army fell short of our recruiting mission. And as the Army has made clear, today's recruiting landscape did not emerge overnight.
Last year, the Army missed its recruiting target by 25%, says Beth Ash, senior economist with the RAND think tank.
And now all the services are reporting that they anticipate not making their recruiting missions this year in 2023. So things are definitely a struggle.
This smaller incoming military force is not the result of a strategic decision or a deliberate debate by policymakers. Nora Ben-Sahel is with the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Having it shrink while its missions remain unchanged, while the types of threats that are emerging in the world, clearly in Russia and potentially with China as well, that's a mismatch in what the strategic environment looks like and how we're prepared for it that is solely being driven by fewer young people being willing to serve.
There's a lot going on here. Unemployment is low, and historically that means fewer people enlist. The number of eligible 18 to 24-year-olds is also smaller than it once was. COVID has made it difficult to do face-to-face recruiting. And finally, Ben-Sahel says there's less trust in government institutions, including the U.S. military.
The fact that the United States was involved in two wars for almost two decades has had an effect on the overall willingness of young Americans to serve. But I think it was exacerbated by the way that Kabul fell, whether you agreed or disagreed with the decision to withdraw U.S. troops, the way that the American people saw it on television made the military look incompetent.
The recruiting shortfall is already having an impact on military preparedness. Thomas Spohr is the director of the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation.
Units have a lower manning level as a result, so they're less capable. And in the end, the Army, if this continues, is going to have to cut the number of units. And the Navy, the Air Force are all feeling this as well. They're not going to be able to sail as many ships, fly as many planes. And in the end, unless America can figure out a way to change this trajectory, we're going to have a weaker military as a result.
Spohr, who served in the Army for 36 years, says fewer troops means more deployments for those in uniform, which leads to another problem.
That, in the end, is going to cause people that are in the military now to say, hey, I want to get out of the military. This is just, I have no quality of life. All I ever do is just deploy it.
Another military veteran, John Noggle, says that the drop in recruiting could lead to other problems down the road.
If we miss a couple of years, if we don't have enough privates coming in, not only do we not have enough people to serve at the initial entry positions, the tank loader from my own experience as an armor officer, but that means that 5 years from now, we're not going to have enough tank gunners. And 15 years from now, we're not going to have enough sergeant first class tank platoon sergeants.
Today, Noggle is a professor at the U.S. Army War College. He says this recruitment crisis needs to be addressed.
This year, the very, very best are going to command recruiting battalions and recruiting brigades, because it is no exaggeration to say that the continued existence of the all-volunteer force and the security of the nation depends on getting more young Americans to serve in uniform.
There's no single solution to the recruiting shortfall, but Noggle and other experts say fixing it is a top priority at the Department of Defense. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
By law, Hollywood cannot alter its content to cater to Beijing's demands, that is, if the studio wants taxpayer money. That provision was in a defense spending bill passed by Congress late last year. This week, members of Congress are heading to California to meet with Hollywood and Silicon Valley executives who do business with China. First under the microscope will be Disney CEO Bob Iger. We wanted to explore the backdrop to this, so we got in touch with Michael Berry, who teaches contemporary Chinese culture at UCLA. Michael, remind us why Congress is concerned about Disney and its dealings with China.
Well, I think over the last several decades, we've been seeing the exponential growth of the Chinese film market. And China, of course, has very stringent censorship practices that are in place. And when Hollywood, big Hollywood corporations want access to that market, they need to adhere to the same standards of content that are permissible by Chinese law. That's resulted in a lot of claims of self-censorship, altering content in order to appease to the Chinese market or get access to that market. And in effect, it also shapes the types of films that are being produced. Things like changing the bad guys from Chinese to North Koreans in one film, or digitally removing anti-Chinese elements from other films, casting A-list Chinese actors in minor parts in films, At the same time, this is not any different than how Hollywood has been doing business for decades and decades. And it's not unique to the Chinese market in that countries and cultures all over the world have different standards when it comes to censorship, when it comes to issues of cultural sensitivity. And so the way Hollywood films look in, say, Muslim countries or in India or in various markets is going to be different than how they are necessarily cut or, you know, edited for a U.S. release.
What exactly does the new law stipulate, the new American law? What's the penalty if an American film company changes its content to meet Chinese demands?
So I haven't read all the fine print, but my understanding is that if studios are found to be complacent with, you know, altering their content to fit to the Chinese market, they could be penalized by not getting access to certain subsidies here in the U.S. or access to certain military benefits. You know, a lot of big war films will get subsidies or get certain shooting backup from the U.S. government when it comes to films like, say, Top Gun Maverick. Those are the kind of films that often benefit from these kind of benefits. And so they might be disqualified from receiving those shooting and financial benefits.
I mean, it's interesting that the provision in the defense bill, now law, does not prevent censored films from being made in the U.S. It just bars government funds from being used to make them. Do you think that's a reflection of the importance of the Chinese market?
Well, the Chinese market is now number one in the world. During the COVID period, it actually took over as the number one box office. And Hollywood has always been a global empire, and those international markets are extremely important. And especially as we've seen during COVID, Hollywood's box office has suffered greatly, and a lot of ticket sales are down, barring those big tentpole event movies like Marvel superhero films. A lot of smaller and mid-budget films are really struggling to get a foothold here in the box office. And so that means the Chinese market has become increasingly important as a kind of rollout venue for these films to get their legging and to make their money back. At the same time, we're in a very precarious situation because during the Trump administration, we saw the beginnings of what was this trade war, which eventually evolved or devolved into a kind of new Cold War. And under that, it's not only been more difficult for U.S. films to get access to the Chinese market, but even those that do get access, people have cooled off to Hollywood films. They're not as excited about seeing a Hollywood film when you're in the middle of a Cold War with the United States and there's so much anti-American kind of propagandistic messaging that's out there on social media. It almost feels unpatriotic for a lot of Chinese audiences to go and see the latest Marvel film.
So Bob Iger has returned to Disney as CEO at a critical time. He's just laid off several thousand employees. What does his China moment mean for Iger and for Disney?
Well, this is a trial in a sense because he's just returned and China, again, is the biggest box office in the world. It's been historically a big part of his rise. At the same time, it also became a big thorn in his side when we saw what happened with films like Mulan. And he's really between a rock and a hard place in the sense that he needs to represent a kind of independent creative spirit and also the largest market in the world that he really needs to get these films and make them more viable globally. And so how he navigates that very difficult question is something that could really make or break this return that Iger is now facing.
Michael Berry is the director of the UCLA Center for Chinese Studies and the author of Translation, Disinformation, and Wuhan Diary. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
When schools closed during the pandemic, many kids fell behind in their academic learning. Their social skills also took a hit, and so did their mental health. Recent immigrants and their children in Chinatowns across the U.S. especially felt this, with anti-Asian sentiment on the rise. Reporter Heidi Shin visited a program in Boston that's helping families and kids adjust.
Emily, I'm blocking.
We're at a preschool in Boston's Chinatown, and it is buzzing. It's the Acorn Center for Early Education and Care. Kids at pint-sized wooden tables solve puzzles, play with Legos. There's an art station and a math station. And there are children waving their little fists in the air, pretending to be angry.
And what do you do if you feel angry? If you feel very angry, you can sit down and look in the mirror.
This is part of a curriculum to help kids manage their feelings, which their teachers realized they needed, since families faced a lot of stresses these past few years.
I always tell my mom when I am home.
That's very good.
It's one of the many programs at the Boston Chinatown Neighborhood Center, also known as BCNC. It's a nonprofit that serves recent immigrant families. They host a preschool, youth programs, an art center, and programs for adults, too. And recently, their phones have been ringing a lot. Here's Grace Su, Director of Family Services.
We receive 4 times the usual referral rate for mental health counseling. A child or a youth not being able to sleep, not being able to eat, or feeling anxious about going out.
The neighborhood center responded. They turned to Boston Children's Hospital. It's a Harvard teaching hospital, and partnered with them to bring in social workers and psychologists to set up their classrooms with spaces to teach about emotions, especially trauma-related ones.
What do you think she could do here while she's by herself?
Smell the flower, blow the bubble. She could take some deep breaths.
Right now in this classroom, there are 3 quiet calming corners tucked into the edges of the room. Each corner is thoughtfully designed to help kids regulate their emotions when they're having a tough time.
Come here. Can you tell our friend about this corner? What do we do over here?
Let it go, let it go.
Feelings.
There's a beanbag chair and mirrors. Pictures of faces on a colored chart in both English and Cantonese. Kids come here to explore. Maybe they're having big feelings, or they aren't quite sure how they feel. The staff focuses on feelings that Chinese immigrant parents might not talk about at home. Things like being angry or upset.
How do you think they're feeling in red?
Angry.
They're in the blue, they're tired, they're sad.
These kids are known as pandemic babies, born during the peak of the COVID pandemic, often into stressful but resilient homes. Living in small, cramped apartments where parents lost jobs, grandparents were scared of being attacked on the sidewalks, and siblings were being bullied online. All the while, racism against Asian Americans was on the rise. The stress led to conflicts in a lot of families, and the kids were at home to see it and feel it. The teacher opens a spiral notepad.
It only works for some of the children, but if they're feeling some type of way, they can sit here and kind of draw about it or write how they're feeling.
It's full of drawings and scribbles and pencil, a kind of preschooler's version of journaling.
So one of the children was writing that they felt stressed, confused, frustrated. So they're writing all of their feelings.
On the other side of the classroom, near the library and toy cars, there's the Fix-It station. 2 girls crowd onto the cozy rug. It's where kids come in pairs when they're fighting or disagree.
What's this one? She is sitting down. And what do you think she's doing while she's sitting down?
A teacher helps them with conversation prompts, like, when you said that, this is how it made me feel. The kids choose a solution from a stack of laminated cards. Ask with polite words. Find a teacher to help. Set the timer so you know when your turn is up.
A lot of them choose the timer. That's a big hit in our classroom, is going to get the timer.
Teachers take note of which kids come here a lot. And they also note who's not using the calming corners, who's doing their best to get everything right, to never make mistakes. Because they've learned that for Asian immigrant kids, sometimes the ones who are doing well at school are the ones whose families are struggling at home. They're trying hard to compensate, so their parents who are under a lot of stress will have one less thing to worry about. They help these kids to find calming strategies, too.
Well, what are her eyes doing? They're closed. She's taking a break. She's sitting by herself in a quiet place. What do you think she could do here while she's by herself?
Boston Chinatown Neighborhood Center also works with recent immigrant parents, one-on-one and in workshops. They teach that it's okay for kids to express negative feelings at home. It doesn't mean they're acting out. Instead, naming their feelings is the first step to learning how to manage them. Grace Su points out that it's different from the kind of parenting that they might have grown up with themselves.
Leading the parents to reflect back on their childhood experiences, their relationship with their parents growing up, messages that they received as a child, and how that impacts children now that they're parents.
BCNC doesn't care just for kids. They care for families as a whole. Staff check in with parents about what else their families need. Job training, English lessons, counseling. Knowing what families are going through helps teachers to care for kids better.
Amber, I want you to help me. Can you help me?
The morning I visit, a little boy is sitting quietly at the puzzle table, not wanting to take off his coat or his backpack. Teachers decide to give him some extra space and time today. His mom said there's a lot going on with him, and he can be slow to warm. Then, eventually, with some attention, he was ready. The backpack came off, and he was ready to learn. For The World, I'm Heidi Shin in Boston.
Tomorrow, Heidi brings us a story of a mother in Boston's Chinatown and her struggle with her son's autism diagnosis during the pandemic. This project was supported by the Dart Center on Journalism and Trauma at the Columbia Journalism School. Joe Biden ran for president with a promise to get serious about climate change. Last August, his administration reached a major milestone, legislation that would pour about $370 billion into the effort. It includes tax breaks if you buy an electric vehicle or install solar panels, and money for companies working on clean energy technology. When the law passed, world leaders welcomed it, but it's also making some close U.S. allies very nervous. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
The title of the recent law doesn't actually contain the word climate. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act, but President Joe Biden eagerly touts one of its major goals.
Now let me be clear. This bill would be the most significant legislation in history to tackle the climate crisis.
Global leaders are delighted to see the federal government finally taking the lead on cutting U.S. carbon emissions. But that dollar amount, $369 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office, also brought anger and cries of protectionism. A big reason why? Because a lot of that money is aimed at boosting American companies. French President Emmanuel Macron said the IRA, as it's known, will fragment the West. In February, the European Commission responded with its own Green Deal industrial plan. Here's EC President Ursula von der Leyen.
What we are looking at is that we have a level playing field in the global competition. This is for us so important.
The European plan includes hundreds of billions of euros for green manufacturing. It will also fast-track permitting and access to public funding.
We have to give an alternative to the offers they get from abroad. We want this industry to stay here and to prosper here.
Last week, Canada made a similar move. Its new budget has $60 billion in tax credits for clean technology over the next decade. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland told Parliament about it.
Our friends and partners around the world, chief among them, the United States, are investing heavily to build clean economies and the net zero industries of tomorrow. Aujourd'hui et dans les années à venir,
switching to French, she said Canada must either meet this historic moment or be left behind, she says. It's clear that she was talking about that $369 billion the Biden administration is putting toward the problem. John Larson is a partner at the Rhodium Group, an independent research firm.
The level of incentives and investment in the Inflation Reduction Act is making the United States the go-to place for clean energy investment globally. And Europe and Canada don't want to be left out of that.
Larson says this is creating competition for investment dollars.
That I think on the whole is potentially quite helpful for the world to continue down the path of cutting greenhouse gas emissions.
The fears in Canada about green energy companies losing competitiveness to U.S. firms aren't entirely gone. But Marisa Beck with the Canadian Climate Institute think tank says she thinks they've quieted down.
You cannot forget that the Canadian economy is just a lot smaller. So if you consider the size of the Canadian population and the Canadian economy, I think the overall level of support is not that far off.
Even with this financial commitment from the Biden administration, much more global investment in clean energy instead of fossil fuels is needed to meet international climate goals. And John Larson from the Rhodium Group says this will only happen if the leaders from the world's major economies get serious.
So I think the developments we're seeing in Europe and Canada now in response to the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act have the potential to start tipping those scales towards clean energy over fossil in the right direction. And I think that's maybe all you can hope for at this stage, but I think that's still a big step forward.
Climate change experts are watching to see what follows from other capitals. Japan, Korea, and China have not yet announced any big policy changes in direct response to the Inflation Reduction Act. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The official coronation of King Charles III will be rich in pageantry and will come with a soundtrack. The sound of bells from Westminster Abbey, the site of the coronation, as well as the bells of tiny churches all across the English countryside. Chris Ridley will be one of the people ringing church bells in and around London.
going to be a very busy weekend. A lot of us will be starting on the Friday and ringing right through to close on the Monday.
The coronation is about a month away, May 6th, a Saturday morning, but plans are on for churches to ring their bells throughout that long weekend. Chris Ridley, who serves with the Central Council of Church Bell Ringers, yep, of course they're organized. He says that weekend will be a logistical challenge.
I mean, some people will just ring at one tower and that'll be it. Other people will be ringing at lots of towers.
England's church towers are home to some 38,000 bells. Each one requires someone to ring it, and there are not nearly enough bell ringers to go around. At last count, there was an 8,000 bell ringer deficit. Ridley has been training volunteers in what is an ancient art.
People think it's just going in a church and pulling on a rope. It's a lot more technical than that.
You didn't ask, but here's some bell ringing 101.
Well, you basically have to learn how to control a bell, first of all.
It weighs over 1,000 pounds.
You've got that weight of metal, plus all the fittings and the length of the rope. You have to control the bell very subtly.
Control is everything. It takes weeks to learn how to make the note of your bell ring at just the right time in coordination with other bell ringers beside you.
And you control when each bell rings, allowing you to ring permutations, which we call change ringing.
That's a group effort with a team of bell ringers called a band. Each person holds a rope controlling a bell in the church tower overhead, and like any band, once everyone knows their part, that's when the magic begins.
Bell ringing is fantastic because it's got so many different aspects to it. There's obviously music, there's mathematics, there's psychology of all the band ringing together as a team.
But bell ringing is in danger of becoming a relic of English history.
First of all, we haven't got enough ringers. And the second problem is that our demographics are a little bit skewed towards the older generations. And of course, you know, come another 10, 20 years, a lot of us won't be ringing anymore. We'll be too old.
That's why Ridley and other experienced bell ringers have been training volunteers, getting ready for coronation weekend.
One of the things I'll be doing is I'll be ringing with a group of 6 learners I've taught, and they're progressing very well, so hopefully they'll be up to scratch by the time the coronation comes along.
The bells of Pershore Abbey bring our program to a close today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you tomorrow.